Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Quick, corporate earnings and farm animals. What do they have in common? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 23rd of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with two companies and a vocabulary word. The companies are two of this economy's biggest names in manufacturing, Boeing and Caterpillar, each of which reported disappointing earnings this very morning. Boeing, you can guess why, the still grounded 737 MAX and its associated woes. Caterpillar, well, you know that one too, right? The trade war, global economic uncertainty, the usual suspects. Okay, now, the word. A word often used to describe companies like Boeing and Caterpillar.
Bellwether.
Jessica Rett there, our go-to economic translator by training, a linguist at UCLA.
The term bellwether comes to us from Middle English, and it refers to the bell that they would put around the neck of a wether.
Which was the Middle English phrase for?
A castrated ram.
Oh.
And that castrated ram would lead the flock, and the bell on its neck allowed the shepherd to keep track of where the flock was.
We, though, speak not of bells on rams, castrated or otherwise.
Historically, a bellwether company is a successful company with a strong record of profitability, indicative of the condition of the economy overall.
Eric Hilt is an economic historian at Wellesley.
Well, the earliest bellwethers were the railroads. And the railroads were bellwethers because they were so critical for all economic sectors.
Literally moving stuff and people around the country. And then later,
it was the large, diversified industrial companies like U.S. Steel and like General Electric that became the bellwethers.
Bellwethers for a very mid to late 20th century economy, right?
And as the economy evolved, a new set of bellwether companies came to prominence.
We got Catherine Dominguez on the phone from the University of Michigan to ask her what the new bellwether companies are that point to what's going on in this economy now.
Apple and other kind of more high-tech companies.
Including one that wasn't making much of a profit until pretty recently.
There's a lot to learn about how things are going with Amazon, and I expect that that will tell us a lot about consumer demand as well as some aspects of the global trade.
Amazon, by the way, reports earnings tomorrow. But what about those big industrial giants like GE that Eric Hilt was talking about?
There's often a view that certain companies that have been there for a long time, like GE, are no longer kind of serving the same purpose as they once did.
GE's had a rough go, as we've been telling you for a couple of years now, selling off subsidiaries, laying people off as the economy around it changed. And as for the bellwethers of today, then, the Amazons and the Apples and the Googles?
They probably represent the future of the American economy much more than sort of the traditional manufacturing companies like GE and Caterpillar do.
Eric Hilt there, getting the last word, because the future of this economy is really more services than manufacturing. High-speed internet access is pretty much taken as a given in a lot, well, really most of this country. It's essential for businesses, for a lot of services that people use, and yes, some trivial stuff too. But if you don't have it, you feel it. And a big chunk of rural America doesn't have broadband internet. And the communities that don't have a hard time attracting new residents and thus new businesses and thus growing economically. The federal government and states spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year to address that problem, but it's not always clear where all that money ought to go. From WABE in Atlanta, Emma Hurt reports the state of Georgia is trying to figure it out.
George Glidden and his wife retired to the North Georgia Mountains from Massachusetts about 15 years ago. The upside, they got to be near their grandchildren. The downside, lousy internet service.
It's no good. It's not worth what you get with the problems.
It was slow. It was spotty. At best, he says, it was dial-up. So now the couple comes to the Lumpkin County Library in the county seat Dahlonega once a week to check their email. The Gliddens use their computers at home a lot. But when George edits pictures on Photoshop for his church, he has to deliver them in person.
When I go to the church, I put it on their computers.
Like through a USB or something?
Yeah, so I don't send stuff through the internet itself.
People visit this library 24 hours a day to get things done online. At night, they pull up in the parking lot to connect to Wi-Fi. The library is one of the few public places in the county with decent broadband. It got fiber optic data service when a nearby university installed it 6 years ago. A few blocks away, Steve Gooch sits on a bench in the main square. He's the area's state senator.
One of the biggest complaints I received ever since I was sworn in was the lack of broadband, affordable broadband, and dependable broadband.
But those complaints didn't square with the maps of where broadband service is available prepared by the Federal Communications Commission.
If you looked at the FCC maps, then we should have all kinds of internet service here in rural Georgia. And we knew that wasn't happening.
Turns out, for the FCC, if just one home or business has access, the whole census block counts as served.
So you could have 1,000 homes, but if only one of them had internet, they would consider the entire 1,000 houses as being served.
So Gooch authored a bill allowing Georgia to do its own maps last year. It became law, so now the state is surveying every location instead of every census block to prove the FCC maps are inaccurate. Turns out, yeah, they are. A 3-county pilot showed the FCC maps missed about half of the locations without broadband.
The dirty little secret here is the maps have always been awful, and everyone has known that the maps were always awful.
Harold Feld is with the national advocacy group Public Knowledge. He's been working on broadband access for nearly 15 years. He says the digital divide is still very real.
That is just simply no longer tolerable for people.
A trade association of broadband providers made its own maps in Virginia and Missouri. They showed the FCC maps were off by nearly 40%. And the maps matter because they affect where grant money goes. Jessica Rosenworcel is one of 5 members of the FCC. She testified at a Senate oversight hearing in August.
Over the next 10 years, we are going to distribute $4.5 billion to rural communities. If we get it wrong, they're going to pay a really big price.
The FCC recently announced it is redoing its maps, and Georgia expects to finish its own by June. Those will be steps forward, says Chris Mitchell. He runs the Community Broadband Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
But it doesn't necessarily help us to solve the overall problem of how are we going to get this high-quality service to everyone.
Mitchell thinks the maps need to show more than just whether a house is served. Remember George Glidden from Lumpkin County? His house technically has broadband service, but in reality, it isn't worth much.
We need pricing data. And then we also need reliability data. That reliability component is very important, but that's not showing up in any maps right now, really.
In the meantime, the Lumpkin County Library is about to move into a new building, and it'll have twice the number of computers as the old one to satisfy demand. In Dahlonega, Georgia, I'm Emma Hurt for Marketplace.
There was a survey out last year from a digital marketing firm that asked 2,000 Americans what they imagine their dream home would be like. One of the takeaways was that obviously not everybody agrees on what a dream home ought to be. New? Old but renovated? Millennials and Gen Xers tended to say they'd want a modern exterior. Boomers wanted something more traditional. You got your suburbs people and people who'd really rather get away from it all. For this next installment of our series Adventures in Housing, somebody whose dream home is something completely different.
My name is Laura Hamilton, and until I was 8 years old, I grew up on a farm in North Dakota. It was a really amazing place to grow up. We grew wheat and sunflowers and soybeans. We had horses. I especially loved my own pony, Princess, that I could ride. In 1985, we lost our farm due to foreclosure. So I didn't know it, you know, at the time as a kid, but I learned later that there were a lot of family farms that were suffering the same fate. Some people might remember from that generation, there was Farm Aid.
Live for Farm Aid at a concert for America, here's Willie Nelson.
Willie Nelson was a big figure in, and so a lot of fundraising and trying to raise awareness. The markets were changing for the farmers. There were very high interest rates at that time, and there were some different like trade issues and things going on. So you had people like my parents that worked so hard and great farmers, but sometimes it's just out of their hands.
I can't wait to get on the road again.
What I first remember is the slow pulling apart of our home, like the deconstruction of our home, the furniture, my bed, my piano that my grandmother taught me to play. On the final day in fall, we packed up the last of our belongings into a moving truck and said goodbye to my grandparents and the animals and left. From there, we moved to a few different places around the country. Things in Wyoming and New Mexico and Utah and different places in Oregon to about 14 different homes by the time I was in college. Especially as I went on through school and ended up going to, you know, thankfully, some very good universities and, you know, colleagues and friends were talking about, you know, dream homes, and it was usually centered around maybe a fancy beach house. Like, I went to undergrad in Southern California, so that was definitely a thing. But I just wanted my parents to have their dream home. I just wanted them to have that security. So one day last month, I got a call from my dad, and he said he saw this house for sale, and it's in this tiny little country town where I went to high school. And my dad said it's right by a hay field. You can go walking in the fields. He has a view of the mountains. They weren't able to buy a house on their own, so my husband and I applied for a mortgage. We were approved. We made an offer on the house. It was accepted. And when I called him with the news, it was really emotional. So they cried and I cried. And next month, right before Thanksgiving, they move into their home that they will never have to leave.
Laura Hamilton in Burke, Virginia. Tell us about your adventures in housing, would you, at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Certainly they had the support of Walt. However, it is important to note that life was not always easy.
Mr. Disney and women in the workplace. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 45 points today, about a 10%, 26,833. The NASDAQ gained 15 points, also about a 10%, 8,119. The S&P 500 pocketed 8 points, 0.2%, 3,004. Snap, the owner of Snapchat, dropped more than 5% today as the company's revenue forecast fell below expectations. Other social media companies were generally better off. Twitter picked up less than a 10%. Facebook finished the day 2% higher. CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified on the Hill today about his proposed digital currency, Libra, by the way. Got a whole bunch of other questions as well, did Mr. Zuckerberg. Bonds almost flat today. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line. And your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We've covered the WeWork implosion the past couple of days, of which I'm pretty sure you know the nuts and bolts, the $1.7 billion that founder Adam Neumann is getting to go away. Also, the takeover by one of the company's big investors, the Japanese conglomerate SoftBank. Today, SoftBank itself, specifically its giant investment arm, it's called the Vision Fund. The Vision Fund is a big presence in Silicon Valley. It plows huge amounts into startups, some, obviously, more successful than others. But as Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports, you can't go around with $100 billion in your pocket without attracting some attention.
SoftBank Group dates back to 1981. It was originally a computer software distributor, a bank of software, not a real bank, as people who work there must get sick of explaining. Today, it's mostly known for its Vision Fund, roughly $100 billion, that it invests mostly in Silicon Valley. Paul Kedrowski is a partner at VC firm SK Ventures.
If you've ever used Yahoo, if you've ever used any ride-sharing companies, it would be very, very difficult in 2019 to not have some way been impacted by SoftBank.
The founder, Masayoshi Son, has a reputation in Japan for creating large-scale positive change, says Kenji Kushida at Stanford's Asia-Pacific Research Center. For example, Son brought competition to Japanese broadband service that cut the prices by about half.
He's not averse to taking big risks, and so far he's been quite successful at it.
But not with WeWork, and that's denting SoftBank's reputation. It also faced controversy last year for taking Saudi investment money. And some economists say such an enormous pot of money has distorted the investment landscape. Mark Kanis is a professor of entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of San Francisco.
It's certainly, you might say, disruptive to the venture industry in some respects, because it really makes such a large amount of capital available that the competition for funding new deals becomes a lot more intense.
And that drives up the prices that other investors have to pay. So maybe there is such a thing as too much money. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
There's a legal fight brewing between California and the Trump administration. I know. What else is new, right? This one, too, is about the environment. The Justice Department is suing to end the state's climate change program. It's an emissions cap and trade market, technically is what it's called. Yeah, that's a mouthful, but as Marketplace's Scott Tong explains, cap and trade has become a key tool in reducing global carbon emissions.
As the name suggests, cap and trade policy is a two-part thing. First, you set a cap on carbon emissions and give out allowances to businesses, basically permission to pollute, that add up to the cap. And then you let companies trade those allowances. If one company doesn't emit too much and doesn't need its permits, it can sell what's left over, or vice versa. It's a market-based idea, says NYU economist Gernot Wagner.
It creates the kind of flexibilities that businesses want in trying to comply with environmental laws. Ironically, anything related to climate seems like a liberal idea, but the cap and trade aspect of it has conservative Republican origins.
California began its system in 2012, and a year later it combined with Quebec's market, because the bigger the market, the better, says Erica Morehouse at Environmental Defense Fund.
So it's basically the ability to, if you want to sell something, to find a buyer, and if you want to buy something, to find a seller.
But the White House argues California, by crossing the border, is conducting foreign policy, which only the feds can do. But even if California wins, cap and trade is no silver bullet. It's complicated, says law professor Alice Caswan at the University of San Francisco. In Europe, for instance, regulators gave out too many pollution allowances.
So you weren't reducing emissions at all. And the same things continue to plague the eastern states' cap and trade program.
Still, for all its complexity, cap and trade is something more and more places are turning to, including a group of 9 U.S. states in the Northeast and South Korea and Australia. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There's about a month left until the next big Disney blockbuster, Frozen 2, opens just before Thanksgiving. It and the bigger-than-blockbuster original Frozen was co-written and co-directed by a woman named Jennifer Lee. She was, in the year 2013, the very first woman to direct a feature film from Walt Disney Animation Studios. I mention that because the groundwork that put Lee in that position was laid 70 and 80 years ago by the women who shaped in their stories and in their art the classic Disney movies that literally made the studio, Snow White and Bambi, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, you know them, right? These women are the subjects of a new book by Nathalia Holt. It's called The Queens of Animation. Nat, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
When people think of Disney and animators, they think typically, I always do anyway, of the nine old men, right? The famous men who were there. The thrust of this book, though, is that really, women were there too, in a lot of really substantive ways.
That's right. And this group was quite extraordinary for the era, because in the 1930s and 40s, most women working in Hollywood studios that were involved in animation were confined to positions in the ink and paint departments, where
What does ink and paint mean? What do you do there?
So these women were tracing the outlines of the work that had been done by male animators and then coloring in the lines using all different colors on cell animation. And Walt Disney was quite unusual in hiring women outside of these positions and bringing them into key creative positions in the story department and in the animation department. And in 1941, he gathers his employees and he tells them, the girl artists have the right to... have the right to expect the same advancement opportunities as the men. And I honestly believe that they may contribute something to this business that men never would or could.
Wow.
And certainly they had the support of Walt. However, it is important to note that life was not always easy for these women. Yeah. It wasn't simple to be a woman trailblazer at the studio at this time.
There's an anecdote, or a couple anyway, of how you like pitched ideas and sold stories, and you had to get up and like act it out in front of a group. And I can only imagine being the only female in this group of animators, and you have to stand up there and perform, basically.
Yes, this was not easy. And I document one example in the book of an artist named Bianca Maggioli, who was hired in 1935 by Walt. And at one meeting, she really has a very difficult time, where Walt actually takes down her drawings off the storyboard as she is up there presenting in front of the group. Uh-huh. He rips them apart, and she ends up running from the room, even being chased by some of her male colleagues. So certainly moments like this were really trying for the female artists. But it is the work of these female pioneers that then brought us to where we are today in terms of women in animation.
Yeah, we'll get there in a minute. I want you to tell me about one more woman, though, Mary Blair. Maybe the best known, right?
Yes, Mary Blair is very likely the best known. And so she was hired in 1940 by Disney. She was trained at CalArts. And she brought a lot of her personal experience to the art she created at the studio. So she brought her experiences of longing for a baby and repeated miscarriages to her scenes of Dumbo. And she then served as art director for a whole bevy of films, from Cinderella to Peter Pan to Alice in Wonderland. And it's really her work on Cinderella. So in 1948, Walt says to his employees, this is it. The film that we're working on right now has to be a success or we're all going to go kaput. And it's really Mary Blair's work on this film and her use of color and contrast that really ends up rescuing the studio when Cinderella's released in 1950.
So these women are there in the 30s and 40s and playing key roles into the 50s. And then in the 70s and 80s, though, there are not a lot of women at Disney and the company has a really tough time.
That's true. After Walt's death in 1966, these female pioneers could no longer find work at the studio. Even Mary Blair, who is so enormously talented and who has played such a key role in the success of so many Disney films, can't find a job at Disney. And it really takes decades before women are invited back to the table. And so I talked to some of the more recent women at Disney, such as Brenda Chapman, who was the first woman in the story department in 1987.
God.
And certainly the experiences of these women really build on the female pioneers that came before them.
You've written this book, you've written other books about women in path-breaking roles. What do you take away from this? And I'll just say for the radio audience, there was a little chuckle right there.
Yes. Well, it's a big takeaway, isn't it? Because women have been part of all of these industries. I've written about women at NASA, and now I'm writing about women at Disney. And I think it's important that we acknowledge the role of women in our industries and how they have shaped, especially here, to have shaped all of these classic films. So it really became important to me to tell these stories, especially because for women in animation today, we see a real lag in the number of women that are interested. So about 60% of all animation students in the United States are women, but only 23% of animators in Hollywood are female. Mm. So to be bringing these stories to life and to show that women have always played a key role in this industry, I think is very important for encouraging women to be going into these fields and to be getting more opportunities today.
Nathalia Holtz, it's a book called The Queens of Animation about women at Disney and all that they did. Nat, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've got an excerpt from Nat's book on our website. That bit about Bianca Maggioli trying to make a pitch to the story department that went not so well. We've got that and some pictures from the book as well at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, a new survey from the National Bureau of Economic Research that shows nearly 60% of people never tip their Uber drivers. Only 1% always tip. And among those who do, the average tip is $3. Also this, male riders tip 23% more than female riders do, which the researchers say is probably because men in general tip more often than women, rideshare or not. And we are out of here. The Dow Industrial is up 45 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ gained 15, also a 10% there. S&P 500, 8 points to the good, 0.2%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.